This is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, 2016. I'm your host, Jake Walters. Occasionally on PNM, we like to sample science radio from other different sources to see how they broadcast science topics to the public. So, tonight, on this Thanksgiving holiday, we offer you two clips from an episode of Big Picture Science. Big Picture Science is a podcast that is also offered to radio stations around the country and is produced by the SETI Institute. That's right, the same SETI Institute looking for alien intelligence. But this episode, hosted by Seth Shostak and Molly Bentley, looks into time, time travel, and teleportation. People know that time moves forward in a straight line, but perceptions of time vary. Just how slow can time move when you're waiting in line to buy those Christmas presents? In this clip, astrophysicist Richard Mueller believes the essence of time can be defined and measured, and that time travel may be possible.
Clocks tell us what time it is, and we've improved the accuracy of clocks to the point that a strontium atomic clock loses maybe a second only every 15 billion years. In other words, if there had been such a clock built at the time of the Big Bang, it would still be accurate to better than a second. But while clocks tell us what time it is, they don't tell us what time itself is. Now, Isaac Newton, he thought time passed uniformly. You know, at a relentless rate, everywhere the same.
But Einstein understood that time was relative, and this is because in order for the speed of light to be constant, something else has to give, and that something turns out to be somethings, and those are mass, length, and time. Another aspect of physics that's easy to recite, but it's hard to get your head around.
But as insightful as Einstein was about the plasticity of time, even he didn't say what time was. What was the essence of time? This is deeper. This is almost a philosophical question.
A physicist at the University of California, Berkeley, Richard Mueller, says he has a new definition of time, one that's testable, and it replaces a traditional interpretation of what time is that's been a fallback for a century.
That idea, which purports to explain why time moves in one direction, like an arrow, originally came from Sir Arthur Eddington, one of the great brains of the 20th century.
And it comes down to what does and what doesn't change in our universe, says Dr. Mueller.
If you look at the laws of physics, you find energy doesn't change. Energy is conserved. You find the momentum, the mass times the velocity, never changes. These are what are called conservation laws. But entropy, which is a measure of confusion, does change. The world is getting more confused.
He's not referring to politics, although in a way he kind of is. Sir Eddington postulated that time was tied to something called entropy. Entropy is a measure of disorder. The more random and disordered a system is, the greater is its entropy. And for any system, entropy only increases. Think of it. You know, the lovely buildings of ancient Greece, well, if you go look at them today, they've mostly decayed, weeds have grown through the floor, whatever. Their entropy has gotten greater, they're less organized.
Typical example they give is if you drop a coffee cup, it will break into pieces. It becomes disorganized. It will not spontaneously come back together.
And that observation that there is a one-way direction for disorder, that things become more disorderly, not less, gave Sir Arthur Eddington the idea that the forward motion of time was tied to the relentless increase of entropy in the universe. And that has been the definition of time ever since.
Since Eddington, there's been no real progress in understanding time. And most physicists simply repeat Eddington's argument. I ask people, why does time move forward? And they say, oh, it's probably entropy.
But Dr. Mueller finds Sir Eddington's idea flawed.
Where I think he made his mistake was in not drawing attention to the fact that all of civilization, all of life, is actually characterized by decrease in entropy. Now, the law of physics says entropy must increase. So when we build a coffee cup out of clay, we're decreasing the entropy of the clay. How can that be compatible with physics? Well, the answer is there's entropy in the heat that's radiated out to infinity. And if you include all of the entropy, then entropy is increasing. But locally, refrigerators reduce entropy because they cool things. When things are cool, they become more organized, just like an ice cube is more organized than liquid water.
Dr. Muller has another idea of what time is that he says is testable. But to get there from here, so to speak, we first travel through a concept which he explores in his new book, Now.
The word now is the essence of the human experience. We all know what it means, and yet physics ignores the issue. Philosophers have talked about it. They've talked about what is the meaning of now. It goes back to Aristotle and before that. And they were equally confused. Now, the flow of time, the meaning of time, is not part of physics. It's mysterious. We know a lot about time. We know that time slows down when you go deeper. If you go upstairs, time runs faster. These are things that were discovered and elucidated by Einstein. But why it moves in the first place, physics has not addressed that issue. My question was, does physics have anything it can say about this mysterious and ever-changing moment we call now?
Well, for a physicist, time is what? Time is just a parameter in an equation, like, you know, distance equals velocity times time?
Well, that's the way it used to be, right up until Einstein. I like to think of time and space as the stage in which the play of physics took place. And physicists looked at that play. They see objects falling. They describe them in terms of positions on the stage and the clock on the wall. Then Einstein did something fantastic in 1905. He said, time is part of physics. This was a conceptual breakthrough. His original theory of relativity does not require any advanced math. It's just algebra. And in that theory of relativity, the thing that was difficult about it was that he was saying time is not a universal constant. It depends on where you are. It depends on how fast you're moving. He brought time into physics. Instead of it just being a way of describing physics, now time was part of physics. That was, in my mind, his greatest genius.
So what he was saying was that time was kind of plastic. It was somewhat flexible. It wasn't invariant, a series of very accurate clocks ticking all over the universe in synchronism.
That was his breakthrough, and it's the toughest thing to understand. When I teach about relativity theory, it's not the math. It's this concept that, well, as I said, you go upstairs and time goes faster. If you take a clock with you, you won't see any change. But when you come back down, then your clock will show a different time than the one down here. It's a small effect, unless you get close to a black hole. And that's what is depicted in some of these recent movies, the slowing down of time. But it's real. I see this in the laboratory myself. I've measured this myself. Modern physics, you see this every day.
The arrow of time is very rigidly in one direction. Are we correct in saying that?
In our experience, we have never seen things going back in time, although Feynman speculated that in the microscopic world, things can move backward in time and do. So he came up with this idea of something we call Feynman diagrams, in which when electrons interact with each other, there's this tiny little region out of reach of any experiment in which things for very short times go backwards in time. It was fascinating, but he actually introduced reversal of time into his theory of quantum mechanics.
We heard from Seth Lloyd that travel into the past might be possible in the vicinity of a black hole. Is that a useful fact? I mean, does that mean we could build a time machine if all we had to do was get to a black hole and do it?
Well, it would be a useful fact if it were a fact. So there was a paper written in 1980s, I believe, showing that if you had a double black hole, something we refer to as a wormhole, that's the sort of two black holes connecting each other, that it could be possible that you can go backward in time by jumping into one end and popping out the other. But when the theory was worked out in more detail, what they showed was that the double black hole, this wormhole, doesn't exist long enough for you to do that. So the speculation was that maybe we can come up with some new force that we don't know about that could stabilize the wormhole. and then you'd be able to go backwards in time. This was a paper written by Kip Thorne, who actually was the scientific advisor for the movie Interstellar. The movie Interstellar gets all the physics right. It's a little bit speculative, but the things it does, it gets mostly right. But Kip Thorne admitted that his wormhole does not allow you to go backward in time, despite the fact that his article published in the prestigious Physical Review Letters had a title of Backward Time Travel in it. It doesn't quite work. That hasn't stopped people from speculating that maybe this force will be discovered someday, people will be able to stabilize wormholes, and then we'll be able to move back in time. Currently in physics, motion back in time is not possible.
Sounds like I'm not going to witness the Civil War firsthand. Okay, well, look, Rich, if time isn't just the inevitable increase in entropy, maybe there's another definition we could get to. You consider a cosmological explanation for the flow of time. Time is a consequence of the fact that 13 billion years ago there was a Big Bang. Can you tell me how that works?
Well, one of Einstein's great innovations is that we exist in space-time and that we should think of space and time in a unified way. So my idea that's put forth in this book and in a scientific publication that is in addition to the book is that whenever we create new space, we create new time. Now, when you think, what do you mean by creating new space? How can you do that? In relativity theory, it's not very hard. For example, if you and I are sitting looking at each other, as we are, there's a distance between us. If I were to take a microscopic black hole, and these things can be quite lightweight, and place it exactly in between you and me, then the distance, the straight line distance between you and me would, when that black hole is there, actually be infinite. The distance from you to the surface of the black hole is infinite, and from the surface of the black hole to me is infinite. So here we have altered space by just moving an object in between us. This sounds really weird, but when you think about it, it's kind of hard to define what space is, and we do that by sending light beams through and seeing how long it takes. And if we were to put that black hole between you and me and you were to shine a flashlight, the light would not reach me because we'd have an infinite distance to go. So space is flexible. It is stretchable. It can be twisted. There are many weird things.
But it can also be created.
And it can also be created. Now, when I came up with this theory, the idea was we know space is being created because the universe is expanding. And so there's more space every second. Let's assume that's the relationship between time and space, that time is going on because we have not just a three-dimensional Big Bang, we have a four-dimensional Big Bang in which time is expanding too. And every new moment that is created is what we call a new now. When you experience now, you're experiencing the Big Bang, the 4D Big Bang, now, now.
We're kind of on the leading edge of the creation of this ocean of time.
That's right. The past exists. It's back there. But we can't do anything about it because the only moment in time when we can exercise our free will is the moment now, the moment that was just created.
So when people ask me, and they often do, they say, what was there before the Big Bang? It sounds like it would be correct to say, well, there wasn't any time before the Big Bang. And consequently, the question doesn't mean too much.
Well, I like to draw a distinction between physics as speculation, which I love to engage in, and physics as science. It is speculative, and I love this speculation, that time and space were both created in the Big Bang. That prior to that makes no sense because there was no time and you can't talk. It's like saying, what happens if two things are closer together than zero distance? The question doesn't make sense. What happened before the Big Bang? Question doesn't make sense. But that isn't really science because based on that, I'm not able to make any predictions that are testable. Now, it's conceivable that the Big Bang is only an approximation, that we had a collapsing universe that bounced. That's possible. And some people have speculated on that, and they make predictions based on that. If we ever see that, see their predictions come true, then we'll take that seriously. But I love the speculation that maybe time didn't exist until the Big Bang.
Well, finally, Rich, because our time is just about up here, there's the idea that at the end of the day, science, and in particular physics, can understand not only the flow of time, but everything. What's your take on that?
I'm really proud of the fact that with this new theory, it is a scientific theory because it makes a prediction that is testable. I was very excited when just recently there was the announcement by the laser interferometer gravity wave experiment called LIGO that two black holes had been seen coming together. Now, as a physicist, I recognize that when two black holes come together, you create millions of cubic miles of new space. Fantastic. There's nothing else that happens that creates so much space so quickly. In a few thousandths of a second, it created all this new space. So that should have created more time, only locally. I looked at the data to see if that could be tested. Their uncertainty in time was about 1,000th of a second. That's how well they measured things. My prediction was there should be an extra delay of 1/1,000th of a second. So it just barely missed.
Oh.
However, in the next year or two, it's very likely they'll see a similar event, but much closer to us. If and when that is observed, they'll have much more accuracy. And my prediction that there was a local creation of new time can be checked. The theory can be ruled out. It's wrong. Or it can be substantiated. So I'm looking forward to this. I think all new theories should have predictions. Otherwise, they're not part of science. They're part of science fiction.
So 100 years from now, in the physics textbooks, you might be remembered as the guy who finally understood the flow of time.
That would be a wonderful, wonderful outcome of all this.
Richard Muller, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Time travel may have already been proved, at least on the subatomic particle level. In this next clip, professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT, Seth Lloyd, describes an experiment in which a photon was teleported instantaneously from one place to another by means of a concept called quantum entanglement. But not only that, the researchers hoped to time travel back in time by mere fractions of a second to notice a possible grandfather paradox. The clip starts out with guest Seth Lloyd describing teleportation.
Yeah, well, it's teleportation of photons, which are the elementary particles that make up light. You destroy the photon you want to teleport over here, and then you reconstruct exactly the same photon over there.
Okay, so, I mean, this has been done before, right? I mean, why was this in the news?
So people have actually been teleporting particles of light for almost 20 years now, but this was the first time that teleportation actually took place over a long distance. Well, 6 kilometers is a reasonable distance, and over standard telecom fiber optic cable.
So a lot of people are going to wonder how you did this, and it involves what is known as quantum entanglement. And quantum entanglement is a term that gets bandied around a lot at cocktail parties by people who probably have no idea what it means, including myself. It's a term to describe the kind of weird idea that objects are, in fact, connected by some sort of spooky mechanism at great distances. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, entanglement is a funky quantum effect. Funky is a technical term here, by the way. Quantum mechanics is the James Brown of sciences. All funk all the time. So it's a funky kind of relationship between two quanta, in this case two photons, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Actually, he called it spukhafte Fernwirkung, which sounds even cooler. And to our, you know, classical minds, entanglement means if we make a measurement on one of these entangled photons, it appears to our brains as if the other photon responds immediately.
Okay, but that sounds like a, you know, violation of what Al Einstein would have said, right? I mean, how can I touch a photon here in my living room, say, and its twin, maybe in the Andromeda galaxy 2 million light years away, knows about it?
Right. So in point of fact, it doesn't violate what Al Einstein would have thought, because you can't actually send information faster than the speed of light using entanglement. But you can do other kind of strange and counterintuitive things, and teleportation is one of them.
All right. Can you describe exactly how they did it? If I were there watching this experiment, what would I have seen? I mean, what, you know, how did they know that it worked? How did they know that they'd sent this photon somewhere else? Because to me, all photons look pretty much the same to the extent that I've seen any.
Well, yes, photons do have the feature that one photon that is in exactly the same quantum state, say with the same polarization as another photon and the same color or frequency, is exactly the same as another photon with the same polarization and frequency. So they are identical, and this is actually important for teleportation. So traditionally in these kinds of experiments, the person who's teleporting, who's sending the photon from one place to another, is called Alice, and the other person is called Bob. Now, in this case, Bob is Wolfgang Tittel, who is a very wonderful and excellent experimentalist at the University of Calgary, because this is a beautiful experiment. But the way it works is you set up an entangled pair of photons between Alice and Bob. So Alice has one and Bob has one. And then Alice takes her photon, which is a different photon that she wants to teleport. She makes a measurement on her photon together with her half of the entangled pair. This gives her some just classical information, in fact, two bits of classical information. She sends those two bits to Bob over, say, the telephone. And then this information allowed Bob to reconstitute or reconstruct Alice's photon at the other end.
Okay, so, but it is essential that she send that information, and of course that goes no faster than the speed of light.
Exactly, so teleportation does not take place faster than the speed of light if you're not in a black hole. And in order for you to teleport, you do have to send a signal at the speed of light or slower, and so it doesn't violate anything that Einstein might have said.
All right, so these two particles, even two particles of light, right, and you know, very often you don't think of light as being made of particles, but I think that that's pretty well established by now. They're connected by something, and what is that connection? I mean, some springs, gears. I mean, what is it?
Well, from a practical standpoint, if you don't look inside the guts of the teleportation apparatus, it really means that if you want to teleport your photon. And by the way, all things that are waves are made out of particles. Phonons are particles of sound. I think that if they had particles of love, they'd be called amarons. if from your practical purpose, you basically have a photon you want to teleport. You hand it over to Alice. Alice and Bob go through their little quantum teleportation dance. And a few millionths of a second later, Bob has your photon. So from a practical standpoint, it just means you can take the photon, destroy it here, and then reconstitute an identical photon at the far end.
And there's no distance limit on that. I mean, you can do this essentially instantaneously if that photon is on the other side of the universe.
Well, again, you're not doing it instantaneously, because in order to reconstitute the photon, Alice has to send a signal at the speed of light to Bob. So you can't violate special relativity. Mm. But it is true that entanglement, this kind of funky, spooky action at a distance, is essential to teleportation. Everything has a wave-like nature, things that we think of as particles, electrons or atoms, but also human beings. Soccer balls have a wave-like nature. So in principle, it would be possible to teleport a virus or a bacterium or, for that matter, a human being. It's not against the laws of physics.
Well, if it's not against the laws of physics, does that mean that this is just an engineering problem that eventually we'll be able to do this?
It's a very hard engineering problem, but yeah, I mean, maybe we'll be able to do this. I wouldn't volunteer to be the first person to be teleported, though, if I were you.
Well, you saw what happened to Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. You know, there was a fly in the teleportation apparatus, and he wasn't reconstituted correctly, as I recall.
Absolutely, and since his name, I believe, was Seth, and that, I take this unkindly.
Yes, so did I. In an analog to the grandfather paradox, and I remind people that the grandfather paradox is where, you know, you have a time machine a la H.G. Wells, you go back in time and you kill your grandfather, which is kind of a problem because how would you be there to do it? There were some experiments in Toronto that tried to send a photon of light back in time and have it destroy itself. How did that work out?
Yeah, that was a beautiful experiment done by Ephraim Steinberg. I was a co-author on those experiments because a few years ago, my colleagues and I proposed, just in theory, that you could use teleportation to understand how time travel would work. And in fact, even though time travel sounds pretty bizarre, and it certainly contradicts the notion that you can't go faster than the speed of light, in Einstein's theory of general relativity, time travel is allowed. And in the current theory of how black holes evaporate, people also speculate that you could effectively go backwards in time. And the method is based on teleportation. Basically, if you want to escape from a black hole, and to escape from a black hole, you have to go faster than the speed of light, by definition. The idea is that inside the black hole, you have half of an entangled pair, and the other half is outside. This, by the way, is well known to be the case. This is Stephen Hawking's great discovery, Hawking radiation. And then the thing that's trying to escape from the black hole gets smushed into nothingness together with half of the entangled pair at the singularity of the black hole, where everything gets smushed into nothingness. And then, under the right circumstances, the photon that escapes outside of the black hole then actually is the same as the photon that got smushed to nothingness at the singularity. So information and stuff in general could actually escape from a black hole, and it does so by a process that's very closely analogous to teleportation.
And this could involve time travel.
Absolutely. So in Ephraim Steinberg's beautiful experiment, basically we took one photon, we effectively used teleportation to send it backwards in time by a few billionths of a second, and then this other photon that got sent backwards in time interacted with the first photon, its former self, and tried to kill its former self. Because what the hey, there's no society for prevention of cruelty to photons.
But that's coming, according to you.
Well, you never know in this day and age. We'll see. One can actually do an experiment, which is really the moral equivalent of time travel. That's what we did.
Yeah.
And something funny happened, which was that I'm not saying that photons didn't die in this experiment. It wasn't like one of those movies where they say, you know, no animals were harmed in the course of this movie. Lots of photons managed to die. But the one photon that tried to kill itself, its former self, always failed. No matter how hard it tried, it failed. And so it was a resolution of the grandfather paradox, because it says, in this version of teleportation to the past, if you will, then you can't mess around with your former self.
Yeah, but is there a law of nature that involved here, or was it just maybe the experiment wasn't up to snuff? I mean, can you categorically say that nature will prevent you from killing your grandfather?
No, I can't categorically say that, although this emphasis on killing one's grandfather, I think, is a little bit much. I love my grandfather. If I met him at an earlier, as he was a young man, I'd take him out for a beer and, you know, maybe introduce him to my grandmother.
Doesn't sound like physics, but...
Well, you know, physics involves a lot of socialization and talking and socializing, and in my case, drinking beer with my colleagues, so I don't really see whether there's anything against it. But we can't really know. So the experiment that Ephraim did was a demonstration of our theory. But to find out if the theory is really correct, we'd need to have what's called a closed time-like curve or a pair of black holes in order to test what really happens in nature when things try to go backwards in time. So the experiment verified the way our theory was supposed to work, because our theory very kindly prevents us from killing our grandfather. But to know that we really can't kill our grandfather, you'd have to see if the theory really applies in black holes and closed time-like curves.
That sounds like a tough experiment.
Well, we asked here at MIT, but, you know, for some reason, the workplace safety people said, no, you can't create a black hole in the laboratory. We said, what? You fools, you're standing in the way of science. But they were adamant.
Well, I want to thank you so much for an interview that seemed to go faster than the speed of light. Seth Lloyd, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay, and if you want to talk with me again, just call me last Thursday.
Seth Lloyd is a professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT.
This has been another edition.